Accession number 32054, Rail 1.
Martin Bell, Rail 1. We last met, I believe, in the after you'd been to Kosovo with a group of MPs, and a lot has happened since then, I know, in your life as well. Could I ask you, you know, given your vast experience as a war correspondent from the BBC, how you got into being a founder member of the Movement for Abolition of War?
I had by that time covered or been present on the scenes of something like 14 or 15 conflicts, and it struck me increasingly that war was not a useful way of settling differences. It seemed to be increasingly futile. I'm not a pacifist, because I think the history of the Second World War suggests that occasionally wars do have to be fought, but I think that they increasingly fail to deliver the outcomes that the politicians expect of them. And I wrote about this in one or two books, and I broadcast about it, and I was asked by these people if I'd be associated with their campaign, and it seemed quite reasonable, because I think some of the best advocates for peace, the best ambassadors for peace, are military people or people with the knowledge of war, because they have seen for themselves how it fails to deliver what the politicians expect of it.
I think you were covering wars for almost 40 years, weren't you? 40 years plus? It's 1966?
Well, actually, I've now spent half a century in the unquiet corners of the world. I was a reluctant conscript in Cyprus during the AOKA insurgency from 57 to 59. And then I started, I suppose, my war reporting in Vietnam, Nigeria, and that was, 67, 68. And I still do it because I'm an ambassador for UNICEF, and they send me where they can't send their celebrities. So in the last year, I've been to the Democratic Republic of Congo, and more recently, Somalia. So that does make half a century, yes.
And during that half a century, Martin, how has warfare changed in your experience, would you say? In terms, I was wondering about civilians, the impact on civilians, whether you have noted any difference.
War has changed phenomenally in that time. First of all, the weaponry is so much more destructive. And second, I think there is increasingly a lack of any distinction between soldiers and civilians as targets. I mean, I would say anecdotally, most of the more recent wars I've been in, the civilians are about sort of 90% of the casualties. By and large, the soldiers are better able to take care of themselves. The civilians, especially the very old and the very young, are not. So I think this is another reason why wars become more futile, because they're fought among civilians and actually for the allegiance of civilians. They are hearts and minds campaigns, and you do not change people's minds with high explosives. So I think that's another change. I mean, you think the last major tank battles were in military conflict were in 1973 in the Sinai, and then again in the Golan Heights between Israel and her Arab neighbours. There have not been tank battles as such on any substantial scale since then. But there have been this increasing proliferation of civil wars, wars of collapsed states, and what General Sir Rupert Smith calls wars among the people.
So could I ask you now about the Movement for Abolition of War? As far as I know, we haven't got it on the record. Bruce Kent mentioned it, but we know very little about the movement itself.
It is a Bruce Kent vehicle, if I may put it that way, in that he's its guiding light, as he is in many. But it has broader. I mean, it is not. I mean, I wouldn't be involved with it if it were only pacifists. It just seems to me to be a useful vehicle for people like myself with military experience to express their opposition to wars as it has increasingly come to be, which is a political option used by politicians who have themselves no experience of warfare. That's another change. This is the first time that our young men and women are sent to war by politicians who, not a single one of them, I'm not criticising them as individuals, but none of them have any experience of war at all. None of them have ever worn the uniform or served in any regiment or in any armed force, whatever. And so they are more inclined than I think to believe that wars can deliver political outcomes, which they can't. Mm-hmm.
How strong is that movement? Do you know, how many supporters do you have?
I don't think it's vastly strong. I think it's a little sort of pressure group on the side, but I wouldn't claim any great force of numbers on our side. I just think it's important sometimes to have sort of ex-military people to contribute to the peace movement, because I think they'll be listened to more than just the usual activists.
Do you belong to ex-services C&D?
No, I don't. I'm not or have not been until now a nuclear disarmer. I suppose this is the end. I'm not a great joiner, actually. I'm not sure about Trident, but I think that that as a deterrent, nuclear weapons have proved their usefulness. They may not do so in future. I'm very worried about nuclear proliferation. But no, I've never been on a CND march or anything like that at all.
Right. Well, I'll move straight on then, if I may, because a lot of the questions I was going to ask you, you've already covered, in your normal, wonderful way, Martin. If I could go on to the Iraq War of 2003, we haven't spoken since 9/11, and out of that came Afghanistan, didn't it, which is, you know, was solved, it was said, in the short term. And then, of course, the Iraq War of 2003. Could I ask you about your feelings about these events?
I think the decision to go to war in Iraq was the worst mistake made by the British government in my lifetime, and most people in the country now agree. It was a war that was launched on the basis of falsehood, that Saddam Hussein was in possession of these weapons. It was a war that was inadequately prepared for. We had a plan for war, but no plan for peace. There was, you know, you break down the door, but what do you then do? There was a very short moment of opportunity when we could have remained welcome, but we were not. And it also drew military resources away from the campaign in Afghanistan at a crucial time. I see Afghanistan as a completely different scenario. I mean, it was illegal in that the military component of the international forces backed by United Nations resolutions. It is to some extent supported at home. It is to some extent proportionate. My doubt about Afghanistan is whether it's doable. This is Britain's fourth Afghan war. We might stop and wonder who won the other three. Again, it's a war for the allegiance of the people, and we seem to be trying to do that with far too indiscriminate use of air power. I was told of a bombing in. I go to Afghanistan quite a lot for UNICEF, and I was told of a bombing in Helmand Province in June 2007. It was a military was a confrontation between the British soldiers, I think it was the Royal Afghan Regiment, and the Taliban, which lasted for 48 hours, and air power was called in. When the fighting was over, so far as was known, there were no military casualties on either side, but 27 civilians dead, including 17 children. I mean, it's the kind of things that's been happening.
Yeah. The run-up to that war was quite long, wasn't it, really, from 2001 to March 2003. The sort of politicking at the time, you know, the way this was sold to Parliament by Tony Blair and others, I wonder if you have anything to say about that, and whether it in any way links with this lack of trust that is emerging in the British public towards their politicians today.
I think it does all connect. The most serious decision that a government ever takes is to send its armed forces to war. This was taken, obviously, in March 2003. It may well have been taken before then. The Attorney General was required to change his mind about the justification for going to war. The weapons of mass destruction did not exist. This had quite an effect on military morale when the soldiers realised, first of all, they were in an unpopular war at home, and second, the reason they went to war was a fiction. So it was an extraordinary set of circumstances, which we, at the time of speaking, there's still been no inquiry into it. But it did. I know a lot of very senior soldiers, and they were nearly all opposed to the war within a few weeks of it starting. In fact, General Sir Mike Rose told me he thought that Tony Blair should have been impeached for it. He felt very strongly about it, and he was Adjutant General of the British Army. I know the families of serving soldiers who went on the peace mark. I found the wife of a major general. This was not widely supported by the army, but of course the army is a can-do organisation. And he doesn't say, well, we're not too keen on this war, Prime Minister, because as soon as it does that, it's intruding into the political domain. And of course, you say it's then going to be cut. But I think that there should have been a resignation at Chief of Staff level.
There was a huge march, you know, the march of, it was estimated, you know, 2 million maximum. Some say more, though, I must say. This sort of indicated the public lack of trust, really, in what the politicians were saying, because at the time, I know Tony Blair was making a very belligerent speech, wasn't he, about war. Do you think that in any way has started off this feeling against MPs and Parliament, that 2003?
I think, I speak as an ex-MP myself, I think our natural respect for those whom we elect is much less than it used to be. We are a less deferential, more questioning people. But I think if there is a justification for going to war, and I think that the Falklands campaign, a bit dodgy though it was backed by the majority of people, and that made it easier for the military. But in those days, there were people in government with experience of warfare, and this is what we lack. Lord Carrington told me that when he was Defence Secretary in Ted Heath's government, every single cabinet minister had served in the Second World War in uniform, with the exception of Margaret Thatcher, and we all think she'd have made an extremely good machine gunner. But there is a distrust of politics. It's acute now. Now we know more about their expenses, and I mean, but I think it's been cumulative. We do not have a sense of being well governed. We were not well governed in the sense of the Iraq War. We have not been well governed in that the proper regulation of the banks, for instance, failed. And there's been, seems to me, quite a serious failure of both of competence and integrity at very high levels. Mm. And in the particular case of the Iraq War, of course, the main opposition party, the Conservatives, did not oppose, nor even scrutinise. So I would say that was a failure of parliamentary government as well.
I knew you've been on television. You made a very good documentary about the treatment of troops returning from battle, those who have been injured psychologically as well as physically. Could I ask you about that now, Martin, the work you've been doing with troops? I know when you did your, am I right in thinking, when you did national service, you were in the ranks.
I was in the ranks, yes. I spectacularly failed my officer selection test, so I empathise with the other ranks.
Yes.
These are complex issues. I mean, one is, and they're actually rather separate. One is, how do we treat our wounded at a time when the defence military hospitals have been closed? And I think their closure, with the drawing down of the numbers of the armed services, was probably inevitable. But suddenly, they've never been more sorely needed, and the NHS replacements are not yet really in place, though they might be in a year or two's time. Separate from that is how we treat those with injuries you don't see, the PTSD sufferers. And that can be 10 or even 20 years down the line coming at you. I know that last time I asked, Combat Stress had about, that's the Armed Forces Mental Health Society, had about 8,000 men on its books, all men, hardly any women yet. It must be more than that now. Most of them were veterans of the Falklands, but the first wave was coming through from Iraq and Afghanistan. And when you consider that our infantry especially is involved day by day in this most intensive fighting since the Korean War, there's going to be a lot of these cases coming at us down the road of bruised minds. And I know, I think we're beyond palliative care here, and various new therapies are being tried, and they're much further ahead in the States than we are. But there is now a realisation, I think, within the Ministry of Defence that this is a very, very serious problem. One of the statistics struck me is we had, 250 men killed in the Falklands, but more than that number of Falklands veterans have since taken their own lives. That indicates something of the scale of the problem.
Yes, it's over 300 now, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. Mm. Yes, that's... And I remember, am I right in saying this, that you are advocating a covenant, a new covenant.
Well, the covenant, what we call the military covenant, is something that soldiers, when they join, are assured exists, that they'll get sort of special. You know, they're making a potential sacrifice of their own lives for the nation, which it happens in no other walk of life, and they deserve special treatment in return. I think the government has come to recognise this. The Royal British Legion has taken it on, so it's not my idea, but I think there are now people in government who are beginning to understand this debt. But I still think we suffer from having a lack of military experience among the politicians.
One of the big criticisms of the MOD and, of course, the government is the lack of protective equipment for troops in the field. You know, have you, in your travels and talking to the soldiers, and, you know, the advantage you have, you this bonding with other ranks as well as officers, what would you...
I think, actually, that they are now a bit happier about their kit. I don't mean just the body armour, but the snatch Land Rovers were a problem. These IEDs are very sophisticated explosive devices, and they can blow the tracks off a tank. But it's quite a complex issue, because all armour, if you're talking about personal armour, you're trading off protection against mobility. The more you put on, the harder it is to move fast, especially in the heat that prevails in Selman province, and the more exhausted you get, and when you get really tired. So I tended myself in my war zone days to go fairly lightly armoured, because I'd rather be fast and dodge the bullets than just sort of stand there and take them, if you know what I mean. They're not easy issues, and I think the equipment is actually much better than it was.
And your work with UNICEF, you were saying you go to Afghanistan quite frequently.
I've been there a couple of times for them. Obviously, I'm not doing military. I'm not with the soldiers. I have been with the BBC radio doing something about women in the military, and in Iraq doing something about chaplains. But what I do for UNICEF, they send me to the war zones where they can't send their celebrities. So, you know, I was there in May. In Somalia, which is a state as dangerous as Afghanistan, and its implications for us. But I get amazing access because I travel under the UN flag. You can get to see things that really shake you up. And I'll give you an example from Afghanistan. Women's prison in Herat, something like 48 young women, mostly teenagers there, all in for the same reason. They were the victims of forced marriage. Married at six, engaged at six, married at 11, to an old man old enough to be their grandfather, complete stranger. They run away and they get locked up for bad behaviour. So that gives you a sense of the society that it was, and to some extent still is. And one of the difficulties of trying to resolve the problems of Afghanistan by force is just sort of drive people back into their compounds and their old ways.
Yes, is it a winnable war?
I don't think it's winnable, but then... I think that it could resolve itself into a country of in this various warlords control various territories, which is historically what it's been. What we're talking about is the question of any central government among them. Central government at the moment is both weak and corrupt, and the West is plowing in ever more resources. I don't think it's winnable, but I hope I'm proved wrong.
And Iraq, do you go there at all, Martin?
I haven't been in Iraq for about 3 years now. I've done a little bit for UNICEF there. Then the UN got bombed out in August 2003. I did a bit with the British Army there, but of course they've sort of pulled out. We've done what we'd like to do, which is to declare victory and leave the field. But I think we were actually part of the problem there. We were not. I mean, the withdrawal from Basra City should have happened before. We were not achieving anything by being there as the chief of the general staff, rather. He didn't do his career any good by saying so, but he was right, and now we're gone, and it seems to be improving.
And the Americans, I believe, are withdrawing.
They're now withdrawing from the big cities, and I mean, it's... Oh, I don't know. Better not ask me about Iraq. It just seems pretty hopeless to me.
What are your hopes about this so-called public inquiry which is going to be held? Do you think that it will be sort of independent and public in the light of what's gone on before, the Hutton and...
It is good that the original decision to hold it behind closed doors has been reversed. I mean, you can't do that anymore. These wars are fought in our name. And we can't have a collection of four or five great and good going to a room and people come before them. I mean, we know from evidence to some very alarming things in the evidence to Hutton. And the Butler report did not, in fact, give the government a clean bill of health, but it had a very narrow agreement. I think we can hope that this is well. It had to come. I'm amazed it's taken so long. It will be about what 6 or 7 years after the event by the time it gets going.
Yeah.
But as I remember, the inquiry of the Falklands Wars at the time said to be a bit of a whitewash. I don't think that we shouldn't call it a whitewash if it just comes to a conclusion that we ourselves don't agree with. I mean, let us see what the evidence is. And if the evidence is delivered in public, we can judge better. And the kind of thing that concerns me is we now know that a very senior figure in MI6 talked in February 2003 with Saddam Hussein's head of intelligence. They did this in Amman, more than one meeting. The MI6 man was assured the WMD didn't exist. The information was relayed back to London and Washington, but by then it was too late. But if that is true, we went into war on the basis of not just a falsehood but a lie, and that should, that's going to affect the judgment of history.
I understand you supported Reg Keyes.
I supported Reg Keyes in his campaign against the Prime Minister in Sedgefield in 2005. Reg, of course, lost his boy Tom as an RMP in a dreadful incident in which six of them died. And Reg is a very brave man, and he just decided he was going to hold the Prime Minister to account in his own constituency. And he waged an excellent campaign. He won 4,000 votes, which as an independent is quite hard to do. He was the biggest vote attracted by any independent candidate in the country, and he was I think that the fact he was able to make that remarkable speech at the count, very, very dignified and very hurt, it had a big impact.
Have you ever been tempted to enter the fray again, Martin? Given all that's been revealed about MPs' expenses.
I'm being asked all the time. I'm waiting to see which of the miscreants is left standing, because so many are retiring or being deselected, and let's see who's left standing. But I'm in favour of what I call the local hero option. I'm talking to independents around the country. People are standing in their own communities who are thinking of having a go against the local MP, where the local MP has been found to be corrupt. And I think that's the way to go, because people are really angry.
Well, thank you very much indeed. Unless there's anything else you would like to put
it's fine.
On. But you won't go yet, I hope.
No.
You're not going to pack up. This is the end of Reel One, Martin Bell.